to another episode of the In Context podcast. Today I'm with Andy Constable, a good friend of mine from up in Nidri. So Andy, just share a little bit about yourself and about what you've been studying over the last couple of years.
Yeah, hi everyone. My name's Andy and I'm up at Nidri Community Church. I'm one of the pastors up there, and I'm one of the co-directors of a ministry called 20 Schemes. I've been in Nidri for about 13 years. I'm just ministering here, and married to Debbie. I've got 3 kids. I started my master's about 3 years ago. The first 2 years are just doing general papers on a range of different subjects. And your final year, when you're doing it part-time, you get to do a master's dissertation. And so that's what I've been spending the last 12 months or so doing. And I did my dissertation on pastoral care and addiction.
So you've been in Nidri for how long now? Is it about 10 years?
Yeah. officially started in 2010 as an intern, but I was worshipping at the church from about 2008.
Great, wow. So you have a personal experience through the ministry of working with addicts. You've been doing that for a long time, so why on earth would you, if you've got a practical knowledge and a theological framework through your church in dealing with addiction, why would you then go on and study it? What was your thought behind writing a paper on addiction?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, obviously got a lot of practical understanding of addiction just through working with people. That's how you, I guess, you learn. I think as a church, we've been influenced, like a lot of churches in the evangelical world, by the work of CCEF and the Biblical Counseling Movement. And in particular, our church has been influenced by a book called Banquet in the Grave by Ed Welch, which is a brilliant book. But outside of that, I hadn't really read much on addiction apart from that book. And so I really wanted to do my dissertation on this subject so I could just read a bit more widely about the subject. And it was as I was reading a bit more widely, I was just researching, and I think I was researching on Amazon. Sorry, 10 of those, but I was on Amazon for a few minutes. And I was just typing addiction and pastoral care, and a book came up that had just been released in 2009 by a lady called Sonia Waters. So I bought it, and I read it, and even though, and I'm sure we'll get into this in a few moments, but even though she was writing from a completely different theological standpoint, a lot of the practical things that she was suggesting and a lot of things that she was experiencing and that she was writing about resonated with what we'd experienced in Nidri. And it just got me thinking, what else is out there on addiction? What are there other things that we're missing that are outside of Ed Welch's and CCF's world and work? And is there things that we need to revise in our practice at Nidri Community Church? And it was just to re-look at things, re-examine things, look at the Bible again and just look at our practice again, because it's always important, I think, just to examine yourself and how you're ministering to people to make sure that you're on the right lines and learn from other people.
Yeah, interesting that we often will find something that we have that either works for us or that we agree with, and we will stick within that camp, especially theologically, and we'll only search, for example, on 10 of those because we trust that site to produce certain theological standard of books. And often just typing in Google or typing in Amazon to find other resources just is something that we've got out of the habit of. Maybe it's out of fear or out of just getting, I don't know, just comfortable and stuck in a rut. So, that strikes me as interesting, especially in this climate where you've deliberately chose to read a book and then research a book that was written by somebody from a different theological standpoint. Because if you look at the evangelical church at the moment, so many people are adverse to and resist going out of their camp, don't they? So how did that feel then? Because I know I've been trying to do that over the last couple of months or a couple of years, is is start reading a bit wider and read from people who I don't agree with on 100% of things. And I often find that challenging. So when you read this book, how did you remain balanced as you were reading it? And how did you manage to pick out the gold nuggets from the bits that you disagreed with?
Yeah, like you said, that what's been good with the Masters is just you get to read more widely than, like you said, than the trusted resources that are given to you. Of course, those trusted resources are great, particularly from a reform standpoint. But it just helps to stretch yourself to read a little bit outside of that. And it will either question what you already know, or it will affirm it, or there might be things that you need to change in terms of how you view things. And that's not a bad thing either, because we're always learning and always growing, aren't we, in grace, and we're always being renewed in our minds. And yeah, I think what I did was I just read through the book firstly, and I just read it with a pencil in my hand. And I just, if you read the book, my copy, you'll just see just underlinings everywhere. And I was just underlining things that I agreed with. I was putting question marks at the things I disagreed with as my first response. I put questions in the margins of my book as I was reading through. And I was just trying to, because I've been so steeped in CCF world again, which is absolutely brilliant, and agree with, you know, a lot of what's been written. I was just always in my mind just testing against that, but also against the scriptures as well. And so there were some things in the book, because he's an Episcopalian priest, you can just you can almost chuck out immediately. So for example, in her book, she looks at the demon-possessed man in Mark chapter 5 and says that's like the addict. And so she does eisegesis. She just reads into the text without doing the exegesis of the text. And so, that, you know, for me, it was like that was fairly easy just to... She's obviously not reading the text, you know, biblically, theologically, exegetically. She's not looking at the context before she applies it to us. And obviously that's a big no-no for us. But some of the conclusions that she brought out of it in terms of what it might feel like to be an addict might have felt a little bit like the demon-possessed man who's ostracized from his community, who feels powerless. It was like I could see that in terms of how she interpreted the demon-possessed man allegorically. And so there were little nuggets there. I was like, okay, I could see where she was coming from, although I would chuck out the premise. But I could see where she was coming from to try and interpret the addicted person not just as a sinner, but as a sufferer as well. And someone who was, you know, addiction does feel like you're possessed sometimes. You know, you look at some of the guys walking around my scheme, it's like they're the walking dead. It's almost like they're possessed by something and ostracized from the community, and they don't have any other way out. And so I could understand the emotion behind the chapter that she was writing, but obviously, like, theologically and exegetically and trying to read into the text, she read into it rather than you know, doing the context first before applying it to ourselves. And so there was things just along the lines that I could reject out of hand, and there were other things like, oh, I need to research that a little bit more. And particularly, she builds a lot of her premises, the lady Sonia Waters, off the back of scientific research rather than biblical research. And so part of my paper was, okay, I've got to look at the foundations or the presuppositions behind where these guys come from. So obviously CCF and biblical counseling would say the Bible is sufficient for life and godliness and for interpreting the human need and the human solution to that need, or the God solution to that need. And they wouldn't really look at scientific findings at all for a variety of different reasons. Some good, some, I think, a little bit more weak. But this lady, on the other hand, instead of coming to the Bible first, she went to the scientific literature first, and then she went to the Bible, which obviously has its own weaknesses, because then you're appropriating the scientific findings with the Bible, and then you're reading the scientific findings back into the Bible. instead of coming to the Bible first and then looking at the scientific findings. And so it meant that she came to addictions through a very different avenue to what I'm used to, a very skewed avenue. And yet there were some things that were brought out of the scientific findings that, again, I would have agreed with, that I agree with, and that were helpful for me as I thought through addiction.
Yeah, and again, you mentioned there, as you were talking and explaining the addict and how she explains what an addict is as a sinner and sufferer, and that was the name of your paper, which is not unique, but I think the unique bit is "and" in the middle, where often we will look at an addict as a sinner or a sufferer. Very rarely do we look at them as both. And just share a little bit of any frustrations that you might have had within your ministry or any challenges you've had because of people's look at an addict as either a sinner or as a sufferer, and how long did it take you to get that point where you'd see them as both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the book Banquet in a Grave by Ed Welch, as many people know, posits that addiction is idolatry, that it's a worship problem. And it's a desire problem. And so the focus of the book is on the soul, it's on the heart, which is very right, very correct. We are sinners who've rebelled against the holy God. And an addict, like anybody else in the world, is a rebel and is a sinner. And, throughout the last 100 years, that theme comes up again and again in the writings of Christians, that there seems to be some sort of a attachment problem from the addict, where they're trying to replace God with other things. And we know Romans 1 talks about that we as humans replace creator with creation. And that certainly describes the addicted person. But what Ed Welch doesn't touch upon us so much in that book anyway, is what about the person's background as well, and how does the person's background contribute also to the choices that they make? Because we're not born in a vacuum. We're born in a certain family, we're born in certain communities, we have certain life experiences that also contribute to the decisions that we make. Now, it doesn't mean that they determine our choices, but they can influence the choices that we make and the things that happen in our lives. And so that's why the other book was really helpful. So if you think generally of Ed Welch talking about the addict as the idolater as a sinner, the other book was saying, no, they're not sinners, they're just sufferers who are running away from pain. So Ed Welch would say it's a pursuit of pleasure, where we're... It's a desire that takes over us, worshipping the drug or the alcohol over God, whereas she was saying, no, it's not really a worship problem. It's not really a sin problem even. A lot of addicts are running away from painful circumstances, and they're trying to cope with the vulnerabilities that have hit them in their lives. And I was just saying in my paper, it doesn't have to be either. It can be both and, and as I looked at the people that I've worked with over the last 15 years or 13 to 15 years, it's interesting, not all of them, but many of them have been influenced either by peer group, because a lot of people are on drink and drugs in their community or in their families. And it was also interesting that a lot of people I interviewed had also had traumatic upbringings and experiences in their lives, and that a lot of them did frame talking about addiction as a coping mechanism for stress and painful things in their lives. And so that's why I named the paper Sinners and Sufferers. That's an addict is an idolater, but at the same time they're also a sufferer, because and they're causing suffering to themselves. They've maybe been through suffering, and they're causing suffering to others as well in their addiction. And so it can be both and. I think in terms of ministry in Nidri, I've fluctuated between the two, but I've probably tended towards the kind of outlook of the addicted person as a sinner. And I think what can happen over time is that you can get quite hard-hearted to people, and you can get quite cynical towards people, because as you work with addicted people, I know this is the whole of humanity, but particularly it comes out in addiction, just the deviousness that goes with it, the deflection that goes with it, the manipulation, the lies, because the addicted person has to feed their habit some way, and they have to live in their narrative and in their reality, and they have to justify it, and they know it's not acceptable, and they probably know deep down it's harming other people, but they have to try and put on this facade that everything's okay, and so just lies and manipulation go hand in hand with drug and alcohol addiction particularly. And so it's easy as time goes on, as you're working with people, just to get really cynical and hard-hearted towards people and forget that maybe there's suffering in their lives as well that needs to be counseled, and that that we need to be soft-hearted towards them, because that could easily be any of us as well. Just because someone's gone down that road and I haven't gone down that road doesn't mean I'm a better person than that person. Just means God's been gracious to me. And I think you're always just balancing that in your head as you're walking with people.
It's interesting, funny, it reminds me of a book that I read by Jerry Bridges, that last statement you made when he's talking about humility and how often we'll judge others on their circumstances, and that we forget that as reformed people, we love to talk about the sovereignty of God, forgetting that within God's sovereignty, he chooses for some to be addicts and some who aren't. And again, it is only by the grace of God that we have been protected from that type of addiction. Although, like you say, we have other addictions, we have other false gods in our lives, don't we? And I think what strikes me is, coming from an addictive background and an area of poverty where I can see that some people will have used drugs as a coping mechanism. I wouldn't say that I did. I took drugs when I was 14 because of peers. My friends were taking them at the school disco, so I took them. But what I found was, when I came off the drugs, was that I can't stand the word self-medicate, because I don't think anyone ever thought, I want to take these drugs because it makes me feel better. I think a lot of people just think, I'm going to take them so I can get off my head. Mm-hmm. But what I found was, subconsciously, that a lot of the mental health issues that I had, or even neurological problems, so I probably would have been diagnosed with ADHD if I was at school today. But what I found was, while I was on drugs, I was less erratic and less impulsive than most people. And when I became a Christian and I came off the drugs, I suffered all kinds of mental health issues and paranoias and anxieties, which I think I already had as a child, but these were masked when I was growing up. But I'd never heard the term self-medicate. I'd never related anything to trauma or attachment issues. So when I first heard these scientific explanations, I was quite offended. I was like, I just dismissed it, because I just thought these terms were excuses for people and for myself, and I would have been along the lines that I was just a sinner. So it's been helpful for me to look at this and maybe have a bit more compassion, if not for myself, but for other people who have struggled differently to me, because, like you mentioned, my initial entrance into the drug life was through peers. But the addicts, the community of addicts is so different. It's so diverse, isn't it? There's so many ways in. So what did you find from looking at your research? was there any differences and similarities you noticed between people from a more affluent background and how addiction affects them, and for people from an area of poverty and how addiction would affect them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I did, in my research, just because of time and availability, I interviewed 8 people. 6 of those who were interviewed were from an area of poverty, and 2 were from kind of a richer background. I think 2 or 3 said that they got into addiction because of kind of peers introducing them to drugs, and they were particularly from Nidri, or the schemes around Nidri. They said because family members were taking it or friends were taking it, and introduced them, and it got them hooked. And once they got into that vicious cycle, it was hard to get out, particularly when they tried to stop. Dealing with stress was really difficult. And so what would happen is they would stop for a little bit, and then something would stress them out, and then they would go back on it again. And so it was like a vicious cycle for them. And then those, if you want, from more affluent areas, both of them had abusive backgrounds in a variety of different ways. And they used the language of they started doing it because they wanted to get out of their head from what they were experiencing in the home or at school. And they started to, if you want to put it that way, self-medicate and just get out of their heads, because it means they didn't have to think about the stress of their lives or the difficulty that was going on in their lives. But so it was, seemed to be a combination of social problems, so peer group, family group, introducing the drugs, but also the stress and pain that goes along with abuse, traumatic events in their lives, and that, so those two kind of things kind of led into to the addiction. And then once they were in the cycle, in the vicious cycle, it was just hard to get out, because like you said, once they stopped, then everything that they were trying to run away from would come back up in their minds again, and they were having to deal with life without addiction, without drugs and alcohol. And once you're dependent on something, and that's your coping mechanism, it's hard then to work out new coping mechanisms for dealing with stressful circumstances. Cause it's easier just to pop a pill or inject some heroin or smoke a doobie than actually sit and having to deal with the stress in your mind in a mature fashion, which usually means talking through it with people, enduring through difficult things, making difficult choices, not running away from problems. And it's interesting that a lot of the guys that I've interviewed would say the minute they started taking drugs is the minute they stopped maturing as people. And so they've had to kind of, since not taking drugs, mature. And the way that we mature is through suffering and going through difficult times by relying on the Lord. And so I think that fits in with what you were saying just a minute ago, which is, I think this stuff helps with our discipleship particularly. So if someone comes from, if someone comes into our church and they don't need the gospel, they need to know that they're a sinner as well as a sufferer. And they need to know that the only way to be healed is through the Lord Jesus Christ. But the hard work obviously starts, as we know, when someone becomes a Christian. And they need the spiritual help in learning their own desires and their own hearts. But a lot of the time they also need physical help, new routines in their lives, new habits to be formed, and the community. So if peer pressure was a reason for getting into drugs, they need to have a loving community around them that helps them and that cares for them and that loves them well, so that they can grow in godliness and grow in grace. And they need to be helped to learn how to deal with stress in a new and biblical way. That's where I thought some of the stuff from the other book was helpful, in terms of helping people walk through their past a little bit, and also helping people to form new habits in their lives and not just looking at the spiritual stuff, which is obviously the center point, but also we need to look at the social environment as well. And we also need to look at biology as well and how the drugs have affected someone's head and their bodies as well, because it has an effect on that area as well. And we're not just spiritual creatures, we're embodied creatures. And so I think at part of the wilderness was banquet in the grave, and it was written a long time ago now. I know that Ed Welch has written some other blogs since writing that book, and I'm sure there'll be things that he would add into that book that were a little bit different to maybe how he would see things today, like just in terms of the causes, and also maybe some of the discipleship that's needed on the other end. I think the discipleship on the other end is something that we have to think well. We have to think it through well as churches, and think wider than just, I know spiritual affects everything, but like we're dealing with the desires of the heart, but also dealing with the human body as well, and working through how we can help that as well.
Yeah, and I think that's something that sadly has been missing from the understanding of pastors and church leaders and church members who are dealing with addicts. And I find it interesting, funnily, how I think every couple of seasons, there's a seasonal church program that they'll want to deal with a specific issue, won't they? So there's different seasons with different issues. And not long ago, pornography and sex was a big thing. And everyone was talking about the biological effects on the brain from watching pornography and the result of the endorphins and how you've got to become more and more extreme with the pornography to get the same high that you got when you watched it. And I heard so much talk on the biology of the brain with porn addiction or sex addiction, but I don't think you're the first person that I've heard discuss it when talking about addicts with chemical addiction, with drug addiction. And just explain a little bit how that biology of the brain makes discipling somebody who comes from an addictive background so much more difficult than, say, if somebody was just dealing with the traditional sins that are brought into the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's interesting that in the last 10, 20 years, like the medical world has focused particularly on the brain, and there's been a lot of research has been done on, you know, what effect drugs and alcohol has on the brain. So it used to be thought, you know, the old argument was about addiction being kind of genetic and kind of passed down from generation to generation. That's now been debunked. And the focus has been more on the social environment that people were brought up in. So a lot of the research that's been done in the last 10 years particularly has been on, you know, the effect of attachment theory and trauma on the brain, and then that leading into vulnerabilities for addiction. Again, doesn't determine that you're an addict, but can lead to vulnerabilities for addiction. And then also the effects that the drug or alcohol has on the brain specifically. The main focus has been on the fact that when we take drugs, specific chemicals are released in the brain, it affects like the neurotransmissions. And that means that when someone stops taking the drug, it means that you feel very depressed and very down afterwards and very low. And that's because your brain's used to getting all these endorphins, dopamine going through the brain, and it's now not reacting because it's not got the chemical that's been injected or sniffed or whatever else. And so part of what I was talking about was when someone stops taking a drug, the first few months are really key in our discipleship, because that's when people are very vulnerable, because they feel so low and they feel stressed and they feel down. And to go cold turkey is very difficult. and without support. And so what we found with a lot of our guys and girls is actually going away for a season has been really helpful. So going away to a Christian rehab for 10 to 12 months is really helpful for a couple of reasons. One, because they're away from proximity to drugs and the temptations that are there. Two, because they get to just reboot the brain, their souls, their bodies by being in a strict routine somewhere else. And three, it's just a place where they can process maybe some of the struggles of their lives and really get into the scriptures. And sometimes it's not everybody, some people can just stop taking drugs and they're fine. But we found that a lot of our guys have found that helpful to go away for a season to reboot emotionally, reboot spiritually, reboot physically, and then come back into their environment and the responsibilities. And that means by that time the brain's very adaptable. It means it can adapt again to the new set of circumstances without the drugs that are flowing around the brain. And so I just found that interesting that a lot of the guys and girls that interviewed, again, not all of them, but most of them have had some sort of time outside of their environment for a season, whether that's in a Christian rehab or in a discipleship house. And that's been really fundamental for their growth and continual resistance of going back to addictions, going back to drinking drugs. It's been really helpful.
Yeah, and again, I think even with rehab, even with the best discipleship in the world, there's a lot of pressure on the adept personally to ultimately, no matter how well the church is or how well the pastor has researched drug addiction, if the addict doesn't have that desire to move forward and isn't willing to work hard, it involves the whole church and the addict to be on the same page, doesn't it? But again, I think for me, there was little, the discipleship, I was pretty much told that it was sinful and that I had to stop taking drugs because it upset Jesus, basically. And I think even though when I became clean, I had to get to the point where I loved Jesus more than the drug. But I think a lot of the problems for me with addiction was it got me into massive debt. It was getting me into relationship problems. And I loved the drug. I loved the high. And I didn't like the negative sides of the lifestyle. So when I became a Christian, I didn't stop loving the drug. And that temptation was there. But even when I found myself discipled well, even well, I found myself loving the Lord and my desire was for Jesus more than the drug. What I wasn't prepared for was certain triggers that would come on through my life even years later. So Friday afternoons, dinner time when I was at work, that's when I used to order the drug. So every Friday lunchtime, I used to get a little buzz but I didn't get the high because normally I'd order the drug. So I used to struggle on a Friday lunchtime because that was when I'd normally get the order in. Sex was often done while I was high, so that affects your relationships. And my relationships were built, and if you upset me, I'm going out and getting high. So things that I'd been in a safe space for about 2 years when I became a Christian, a church helped me and moved me off my estate. So I was similar to a rehab. So I was free from temptation. I spent a lot of time in the Word and growing in my relationship with Jesus. But the hard work didn't really start till I entered back into civilian life. So that was when I was faced with having to deal with being a husband or dealing with being a father when I was struggling financially or when I was bored. So how can churches help people post-rehab, post-getting clean? Because it's a long journey, isn't it? And it doesn't just affect, addiction isn't just about taking drugs and getting high. It affects every area of your life. So how do you prepare the person post-rehab?
Yeah, exactly. Your point is bang on. The rehab's the easy bit. a lot of these Christian rehabs are brilliant because they just have intense discipleship every day and all responsibilities are taken off their shoulders. So they don't have to worry about their money or what they're going to eat or stressful circumstances in the home, dealing with the kids, dealing with a wife or a husband, and the stressful things that we have in life. And so the hard bits when, as we pull it, you get back into the concrete jungle and you're faced with the temptation and you're faced with the decisions you have to make and the responsibilities of family life. And a lot of addicted people have not had any responsibilities in their lives, and for a variety of different reasons, but that can make people quite lazy and quite self-centered and selfish, and in a kind of serve me mentality. So coming out of that environment and coming into the local church or back into your family or wherever it is, and suddenly you've got responsibilities and paying bills and all that kind of stuff can be very stressful. And like you said, can trigger people just say, you know what, I'm not going to bother doing this anymore. I'm going to just run back to the drink and drugs again. So, I mean, a number of things that we do at Nidri. The first thing is keeping people busy. So when they come up straight out into something, some sort of routine. We're very blessed in that we've got a cafe that we run, and we've got various ministries that run every day. The way we set up our ministry is that it's everyday ministry throughout the week, and so there's always someone around, or there's always something going on that people can get stuck into. And so we have if someone's coming straight out, we'll put them straight into a kind of an internship program where they're kept busy during the week. And the second thing we'll do is we'll make sure they have a one-to-one relationship where the person checks in on them each week, reads the Bible with them, prays with them, does the normal stuff of discipleship, which is so important. Because one of the interesting things is with a lot of the scientific research, and this is just a biblical thing, is that having some sort of long-term relationship with someone who's not in that world, who loves you and cares for you and is there for you, is really important for us all, but particularly for the addicted person, someone to rely on and someone to encourage them and someone to kick them at the backside is really, really important. So we do that. And then thirdly, it's getting people back into the workplace. That's really important. And so we've set up a back to work project to help people get back into work. So whether that's helping them find a job, help them set up businesses, or to employ them in one of our businesses that we're running. And so we take guys from Christian Rehab from all over the UK, particularly Scotland, and we have kind of tracks them to get back into work, which I think is really, really important. In terms of like one of the criticisms of my paper from my marker was I didn't talk about how this could a church that's not in a housing scheme replicate what we're doing. Because we're a unique church. We're in the middle of a council estate. We've got a good number of staff. We've got ministries running during the week. We've got the back to work project. We've got all these things set up. What if you're more a gathered church? What could you do to support an addict? And I think the UK, of course, UK, we need to think more strategically about what interns we're taking. And so again, the argument about don't just take interns from seminary. Could you take an intern from a Christian rehab who's just had a year in rehab and take them and train them up and take them from their environment and bring them into your environment and give them a family and a friendship? Could we more strategically across the UK churches take on people like that rather than just the traditional interns from UCCF or Christian unions or from, you know, from seminaries. The second thing is support churches that are doing it. So could a bigger church support a smaller church like one in Middlesbrough, one in Edinburgh, or whatever else, who are able to do that? So maybe your church isn't set up to do that and you don't really know what you're doing with guides. Well, support those who do know what they're doing and get alongside them so that they can support guys coming out of rehab or guys coming away from addiction. And then the third thing is, could you change the philosophy of ministry that you're doing at the moment from being more gathered to more local ministry, because you know, in Scotland anyway, the figures are the poorer the area, the more high percentage of addicts there are, and so could you do a work in a local community? Could you plant a church? Could you revitalize the church there and get alongside the people in that community to share the gospel and disciple them long term? And that's part of the argument of Medhurst Ministries, part of the argument 20 schemes, like, oh, everyone needs the gospel, rich and poor, but could we think a bit more strategically about how we're reaching the poor and getting alongside guys from addictive backgrounds? And so I think there come some things that churches could consider in the coming years in terms of their strategy and philosophy and ministry.
Awesome. And again, your paper, I found that coming, I think the danger is often seeing yourself as an expert. I spent from the ages of 14 to 28 taking drugs, and then spent the last 15 years in ministry working with drug addicts, and you can kind of think you're an expert in the field and there's nothing more to learn. But just reading your paper there, I was reminded of things I'd forgotten and learned quite a few new things as well. But I think the biggest thing was convicted, and that I was just seeing somebody as a sinner rather than as a sufferer as well. So it was really educating for me to read that paper. Is there any opportunities for our listeners to learn a bit more, or to read your paper, or hear a bit more about from your research?
Yeah, I think if people want to email me, I can send the PDF out to them. I think it will be published online soon through the Union School of Theology. They put their papers up, and so you should be able to look at Sinners and Sufferers. If you want to just read the books that I read, obviously Ed Welch, I think most of listeners would have read that. If you want to read an alternative book, Sonia Waters, her book is just called Pastoral Care and Addiction, which is a really good book. Another book by Linda McCandante, who's written a book called Victims and Sinners, which is really helpful, looking at the AA movement particularly. And then the last book I recommend, let me see if I've got it here. The last one I recommend is, I haven't got it here, two last books I recommend. A book I recommend from a non-Christian background, non-Christian author is Dr. Gabe Mate, who's written a really accessible book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. He works with addicts in Vancouver, and a lot of his stuff is really, really interesting to read. And then lastly, from a Christian point of view, it's not specifically on addiction, but I found his understanding of humanity really helpful, and counselling is a book by a man called Dr. Eric L. Johnson, who's written two big books, one called God and Soul Care, and the second one is The Christian Psychology Proposal. And looks at the biblical counselling movement and looks at the strengths and weaknesses of it, and that was really helpful for me to think through, you know, where Reformed Christians are strong and where they're weak, and where do they need to improve and where do they need to grow. And he is Reformed, he's evangelical, but he thinks that sometimes the CCF movement can be quite boxed in terms of its analysis of humanity, in terms of just idolatry. And if you look at the Puritans and the Reformers, they didn't just look at the soul, they looked also at the physical, and they also looked at the social, and they looked at things wider than just idolatry, and the shame, guilt, how that affects people, suffering and all those kind of things. So they would be books I recommend to read further on the subject if you had time.
Awesome. I'll definitely take a look at that one. But brother, I'm going to have to love you and leave you. Nathan's been stood outside for the last 10 minutes while we've been chatting. I didn't want to interrupt you, so I've just left him stood in the cold.
Sorry.
Oh, mate, this was awesome. Thanks very much.
Bless you, man.
For joining us, mate, and hopefully I'll see you soon, brother.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks, man. God bless, mate.